It's time for The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cyclists, trails, travel, advocacy, the bike industry, and much, much more. You can subscribe to our weekly podcast at OutspokenCyclist.com or through your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. Thanks for tuning in today. This episode features two incredibly thoughtful and knowledgeable guests. First is someone I would term a Renaissance man. At least, he's a modern Renaissance man. Adam Rogers is curious about a lot of things, and while we have a great topic that he recently reported on about bike lanes and their impact on businesses, I just had to ask him about some of the other projects he's delved into in his career as a journalist so far. One such project involved color, and you might remember the controversy. Did you see a blue dress with black fringe or a white dress with gold fringe? And does it matter that you saw one or the other? Adam thought it was not only interesting, but while working for Wired, he dove headfirst into the subject, and there's even an extensive Wikipedia page about the phenomenon. There's so much more, and we'll talk with Adam in a moment. In the second part of the show, my conversation is with author and journalist Peter Flax. Peter and I first spoke when he became editor-in-chief of Bicycling in 2010. That was a long time ago. And since then, he's moved from the East Coast to the West Coast, worked for some other publications, and now he's written one of the most interesting books I've read in a while. Live to Ride, Finding Joy and Meaning on a Bicycle is Peter's treatise on the bicycle world from the unique perspective of having seen almost every manifestation of bicycling, from the utilitarian to the ultra-competitive. Peter will be with me in the second part of the show. Adam Rogers is a senior tech correspondent at Business Insider, covering science, technology, and our weird future. He reports on how technology changes the way we live. I saw his article, Bike Lanes Are Good for Business, posted on March 7th and wanted to find out what he discovered. What I discovered is that Adam doesn't go off half-cocked on a subject. In fact, he uncovers as much as he can find and then digs even deeper to reveal things many other journalists might miss or, worse, gloss over. In addition to the dress controversy I mentioned at the top of the show, we also discuss another passion of his, booze. Proof, The Science of Booze, is the book he wrote that came out of his discovery that we didn't know much about the science of distilling liquor. Oh yeah, we also talk about bike lanes and what the differences are between reality and perception when a bike lane is introduced into a neighborhood. It's such a good conversation that I never even thought about taking a break. So grab your beverage and here we go. Hello, Adam. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for being my guest today. How are you?
I am well. Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. I came across your article about bike lanes, and of course, I had to dive into it. You really dove into it. But before we actually get into that topic, I'd like to know a little more about you, because you've written some interesting things. And I think a lot of people will remember this, that there was some science behind a picture that some people saw a white dress and some people saw a blue dress.
Yeah,
and
dress,
you actually do. How weird was that?
It was an amazing day. It was pretty wild. Maybe people will remember this and maybe they won't. You know, it's been a few years, but there was a picture that got spread around, started on BuzzFeed, that was a picture of a woman in a dress from behind, and when you looked at the dress, some people saw the dress as being blue, so I can remember this right, as being either blue with black fringe or white with brown fringe or white with gold fringe. And when you saw it, your brain sort of chose one and you stuck to it, but it was almost random who could see what. And so it like divided, it was polarization, you know, before we got the kind of polarization you get on the internet today. And as it happened, I had almost 15 years before it, at that time even, I had spent a fellowship at MIT in large measure looking at color and the way human beings see color. as a thing that I would eventually go on to write a book about. And so I eventually did write that book. It came out a couple of years ago. But I looked at that and said, oh, I know what this is. Like, this is a neuroscience story. This is a brain science story. It's a cognitive story. It's a color perception story. And I grabbed it, and it was a race, because we knew in my newsroom, I was working for Wired at the time, and we knew in the newsroom that every newsroom in the country was working on that the obvious next story was, what is the science of this? I was ready. It was good. It was finally I was prepared for breaking news.
Ahead of the curve.
I heard it. That's right. Yeah, or on it, at least. I was surfing it. Definitely, I was on a surfboard on the big tsunami of the news. It was the thing that I like about that, and it is sort of relevant here, is that in one sense, it was completely frivolous, right? Like, in one respect, it was a story that didn't matter, you know, capital M, but it did, because for one thing, it divided people, you know, and it made, you know, it sort of put people on two sides of an issue that they wanted to understand why they were on those sides. And so that's really highly relevant today, I think. But also, this is a thing that obsesses me, that you can explain why the world is the way it is, that you can do science on stuff and try to understand it better. And there are answers. Now, people don't have all those answers. And the interesting part of science are the places where people don't have an answer, not where they do. When they do, it's done, you know. But you can, that the process is something valuable and powerful, and that you don't have to be out in what Carl Sagan called the demon-haunted world, where it's just all magic and mystery. That can be exciting, but it's not the end of the story, and that we as humans have the ability to apprehend the world around us. And that's what I write about in all the different things that I've covered. And that's what was going on in the dress, that I knew I could look at it and say, like, no, there's a way we can at least have some hypotheses. We understand enough. I say we, like you and I are doing the science. Scientists understand enough about how, and they don't understand everything by any stretch about how the human brain works, but they understand enough about how the visual cortex works and how color receptors in the eye work, light receptors in the eye work, and how light works in the world, to at least kind of address this in more of a way than just saying, like, whoa, that's amazing. It's wild. Why would that be? It's crazy, man. Like, we can do more. And I care about that. So that's what I got to do when I wrote that story, and the bike story too.
Well, the bike story is very interesting, but I want to go back to one thing, because this is of interest to our household in particular. Proof, the science, yes, of booze. What's the story behind that one?
another obsession of mine. If the camera was turned around, we're on video right now. If the camera's turned around, you'd see a couple of the two various bars in the house.
Bourbon?
There's a lot of brown liquor. Okay. And there's still a few, you know, half and third fill bottles from a trip to Scotland and Ireland I took, I guess it's over a year ago now, brought back a nice, some nice samples. I'd gotten interested initially in single malt whiskey, and had gone with my dad on a trip to Scotland to distilleries and got interested in kind of cocktails. In the 90s, at the beginning of blogging, one of the very, very first blogs, in fact, the person who I later became friends with was one of the people who started it, was at Wired about cocktails, excavating historical recipes and trying to look for ingredients that you couldn't find. At the time, you couldn't get maraschino liqueur in the United States. And so you couldn't make an aviation drink from the Prohibition era. And so I got obsessed with going to Europe, getting a bottle of maraschino, being able to make an aviation, stuff like that. I started to care about it. And I wrote this story for Wired about a mystery. It was a detective story. There was a black fungus growing outside and near warehouses where they were distilling bourbon. And a researcher, a mycologist, a guy who studies fungi, had figured out what it was and realized that it had been misidentified in the historical canon of fungological or mycological research, and he was an interesting guy, and so I went to meet him in Canada and talk about how he'd figured out what it was, and we met his mentor, and I wrote this story. And the thing that interested me the most about it was that this fungus was millions of years old, but it had found this ecological niche outside whiskey aging warehouses, and human beings have only been aging whiskey at scale for a couple hundred years. So I got really interested in trying to figure out, like, how can that be? How can there be something that's millions of years old but finds this bespoke micro paradise outside a bourbon warehouse? And in the process of doing that story, I'm making the story longer than it has to be, but it delights me. In the process of working on that story, I thought, like, well, there has to be a, I got to find a book, you know, a popularized written for non-scientists book about the science of distilling, because I need to know how it works, because I need to understand what the exhaust is off of a bourbon warehouse, you know, a rick house. And there wasn't one. It didn't exist. The most recent thing that had been written about distilling for an accessible and easily accessible, there wasn't even a lot of scientific research. There was some, but a lot of it was corporate funded, company funded. And then, there was one book, it was from the 40s. And I started learning all kinds of interesting stuff just as a side thing. That always happens when I work on a big story. So I was learning a thing, for example, about how when we distill grains, so corn or barley, rice even, those are mostly starch. And humans can digest starch. We have enzymes in our saliva and in our stomachs that can digest the starch. Starch is a sugar, but a polymer. So there's multiple molecules of sugar. But yeast, which are the critters, the fungus that eats sugar and excretes alcohol, cannot digest starch. They don't. They need simpler sugars. So one of the issues that a person making beer or whiskey or sake faces is, how do you convert the starch in your base, in your substrate, into a sugar that the yeast can eat and turn into alcohol? Because what you're trying to make. And in beer and in whiskey, they do that by saccharification. They sort of cook they cook it for a while, and it simplifies and gelatinizes and turns into a simpler sugar. But if you're making a tequila or an early version of tequila, if you're using agave plant, a cactus, to do it, then you in early days, they steam it underground, like they cook it underground and get, that's why it gets that smoky flavor. But there was a corn-based drink that was made in South America and some countries further north called chicha that was made out of blue corn. And women would sit and chew the corn first. And so the amylase in their saliva would break down the starch. And then they would make these little cakes. They would spit it out, make these little cakes. And then that's what they would let it sun dry. And it would, so there wouldn't be any gross stuff in it. And then they would ferment and I think distill those, maybe just ferment those. Chicha just fermented. But if you're making sake, which is rice, you actually have another fungus called koji, which is present in a lot of Asian foods. And the koji breaks down the starch into sugars first before and even as the yeast is digesting. I got fascinated by this stuff. And I was telling that exact story to a colleague of mine, a guy who's now an editor at the New York Times Sunday Magazine. I was telling him all that stuff with all of the excitement that I just said to you, because I'm fascinated by it and I think it's really cool. And he looked at me and he said, Adam, that's a book. And I said, what? Which part?
Of course it is.
which part? And he said, well, all of it. And I thought about it, I thought, oh man, there is really a lot here. And nobody had written it. Nobody had written a popular version of it. And it appealed to two audiences, because it appealed to the booze audience and the science audience, of which I am both. And we went from there. And I knew I had a good idea when I would tell other journalists about it, and they would, their pupils would dilate a little bit, and they would go, oh, that's a good one. They knew. So it did. A lot more people read it than the color book, I'll tell you that.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce you. We're speaking with Adam Rogers. He's a senior tech correspondent at Business Insider. He covers science, technology, our weird future, and he reports on how technology changes the way we live. And we actually are going to talk about something that has to do with bicycles, although I really am interested in the boost part. I think that sounds really cool. And the dress part was really cool. But anyway, give us a little bit of background about you, although now I've already got some of it, because you have so many amazing interests, and clearly when you get one, you dive in head first.
I do.
So
I get obsessed.
We'll get to the bicycling connection. I also want to know, do you ride a bike?
Not with any regularity. I know how to, but part of the reason that I got interested in bike lanes is that, this is going to sound weird, I'm 53. I would love to be riding a bike around my smallish, cute city where I live. And I'm honestly too scared to, because I'm not that good a cyclist. I know how to ride a bike, but I'm kind of scared to do it. And my city has, candidly, a lot of older drivers. It has a lot of Tesla Model Xs and Ford F-150s and SUVs and no, really very few protected bike lanes. Cities around me do. I live in the East Bay, Oakland and El Cerrito have protected bike lanes. Berkeley doesn't. And so I don't want to. I think I'll get killed. People do. It freaks me out. And so that's like a personal reason, because I like riding bikes. It's fun. But I'm not going to do it as a hobby. It's not my hobby. It's not my sport. It's a useful mode of transportation, and I'd like to use it I'd like to use it for that. And I'm honestly too scared to do it.
Well, and that seems to be the bane of a lot of people's existence, because COVID encouraged people to get on a bike and ride. And post-COVID, it's beginning to sort of dwindle again in some sectors and stay the same in others. But I absolutely understand we no longer ride on the road. We ride paths and trails and the towpath. And my husband and I ride a tandem. I'm like, I'm not getting back on the road. And I'm in the business. This is, you know, bicycles have been my life for almost 50 years. And it's like, nope, not anymore. And we live in a ring suburb of Cleveland, and it's, you know, people actually are used to seeing bikes, but they don't care. It's not like they respect them.
No, I think that, you know, there's some interesting science about kind of the psychology of drivers, and I experience it too. I grew up in Los Angeles. I've been driving since I was 15, if not a little younger. I think cars are fun as hell, and I think the sort of feeling of driving fast at night with a window down on a freeway is one of the better kind of vibes that a human being can experience. But, you know, when we drive, and now I can use we because I do it too, we see the world through kind of a proscenium made by the windshield. And it assumes a sort of not less of a reality, but we feel like we're, you know, just as entitled to space as a vulnerable kid walking with their parent or as a bike. Right. And we think that we're driving and everyone else is traffic. Like, some weird stuff happens in our head, and it happens to me too. And I don't want to be on the business end of that on a bike. Like, I'll mess up I'll get doored or bumped or whatever. And so, that's not, you know, there should be room for both. I don't want people to not get to drive as much as they want, but there should be room for other options for a lot of reasons that I'm sure you already know well.
Yeah, I do. But, and I agree with you 100%. We've grown up, me too, with driving. You know, 16 was the magic number.
Yes.
You put your bicycle in the basement and you grab the car keys. So let's talk a little bit about the article. It's March 7th. It was Business Insider. Bike lanes are good for business. My husband and I were talking about your article last night, and he, without ever reading it, he knew exactly what it said, because he has thought about this. I mean, he's a bike designer. This is what he does. He's an engineer. He's into all that stuff. But he also understood that bike lanes are going to be good for some business and not necessarily all business. So tell us what you found. This article is fascinating. We will post a link to it on our site. And I recommend that all of my listeners read it, because they know how interested I am in urban transportation and sustainability and walkable, bikeable cities. So go.
So here's the fundamental issue, two fundamental issues, really. One is that people drive generally farther than they will bike, regardless of whether there are protected bike lanes for them or not. And two is that when cities put protected bike lanes at various levels, you know, the share of the sort of paint, anything from like painted to separated with concrete bollards, those tend to replace or displace street parking. Now, there's a lot of good research dating back 30 years, a little bit more, on how free street parking is a real detriment to the smooth functioning of a city at every scale: traffic congestion, pollution, economics, sort of how people get around. But it's one of those things that, like, urbanists who are real into it know about Donald Shoup's work on parking, and it still hasn't, in most places, filtered into cities. Although a lot of cities in their new zoning rules, when they're trying to build new housing, will also say there are no more minimum number of parking spaces you have to build for these apartment buildings. That's what that research comes from. Okay,
right.
It's related. So if you are if you and I were by fiat putting a protected bike lane down into a medium-sized city, we would go, well, where are the high streets? Where are the shopping streets that people want to go to? And let's put the bike lane to those, and maybe past some schools too, you know, like places where people might want to ride bikes. If you're a retail owner, if you're a shop owner, shopkeeper on one of those streets, your knee-jerk reaction to that, and I know it's a knee-jerk reaction because it happens in every American city where they try to do it, and it happened in the European cities where they did it too, is to say, you can't take away my customers' parking. I'll go out of business. And that's the immediate response that shopkeepers have. So if I come at a street like that, if I come to a city council meeting and I start saying things like, look, if more people cycle, you build more bike lanes, more people cycle. More people cycle, they're healthier. There's less pollution in the city. There's less car traffic. There's less climate change because people aren't driving, and transportation is a huge sector for emitting carbon that causes climate change in the world. It's quieter. It's more pleasant. And more people can, kids can go places where they couldn't before because they aren't driving yet. And families can do that. And with new kinds of bikes, you know, people can actually do some of their marketing with bikes or get their kids around. And e-bikes are important for that too. And there's a lot of ways that cities get a lot better if we put people, if we share these modes, if we put people on bikes. I can say all those things and I buy them. I'm like, that sounds great. I want cities like that. I look at Paris, what Mayor Anne Hidalgo is doing in Paris, and think like, well, I want a city that looks like that. I want to be able to bike and get the best baguette in the world and then go to work. Okay, well, the shopkeepers, who are the ones who pay the taxes, pay a lot of taxes in cities, and who are a major interest group, importantly, because they're driving the economics of the city in a lot of respects, and are already in trouble because Amazon and other things like it have ground American retail into dust, will say, you're going to put me out of business. People aren't going to want to ride their bikes here anymore because there won't be any shops on this street. And if you're a city council person or mayor, you take that very seriously. You should take that seriously. So every time there would be an announcement of a bike lane that would get that kind of resistance in the past few years, I have gone on social media and said, does anyone have any actual science, any actual research, economics, sociology, whatever, urban planning, that shows what happens to the businesses next to a bike lane when they put in a bike lane before and after? Do they go out of business or not? And then I mentioned I was in Berkeley. Berkeley wanted to build one. To and past a lovely short couple, three blocks of shopping called Hopkins Street, with like a supermarket that sells the best California produce you've ever seen, and a butcher shop, and a brilliant expensive liquor store, and a great fishmonger, and you know, just like the kind of place that you think like, this is the best thing about living in kind of a urban suburban environment, you know. And the neighborhood and the shopkeepers just went ballistic about it. They fought it tooth and nail. And some of that is, you know, California especially, people fight land use changes. It's a thing for a bunch of different reasons, from tax bases and stuff like that. But also, you know, this place went by, it goes past three schools. You know, it's on a major street. It's perfect. For every reason, it's a perfect place for a protected bike lane. And they fought it like hell. And I thought, well, why? Well, do they have reason? I want to be empathetic to this. I want to be sympathetic. I want these businesses to stay in business too. I go to them. I don't want to lose that butcher shop. And finally, when they seem to have killed that plan now, and when that kill finally came through, I said, all right, I'm just going to go read this work. Like, I got to go find it. I want to go find it. And there was, over the past, you know, 30 years or so, there were 35 studies, reports, published, some of them peer reviewed, some of them just reports out of departments of transportation, but reputable, you know. And I just said, I said to my boss, like, look, I'm just going to read them all. I need a couple of weeks. I'm going to read them all and see what they say. With, you know, of course, I had a hypothesis. I was pretty sure what they were going to say is like, they're fine, you know, but I wanted to know. And what I found was that after doing the reading, that many, many, many of them were just surveys. Not just, I'm being a kind of a jerk about that. They were surveys. The people, you know, good researchers, qualitative and quantitative researchers, have gone and interviewed people at neighborhood high streets about their opinions about bike lanes, or about what had happened with the bike lane, or how much money people spent. I see you're riding your bike. How often do you come to this neighborhood, and how much money do you spend? You know, really useful questions. But I read them and I felt like, okay, well, survey data is not as useful here methodologically, because people misremember, they get stuff wrong, they lie. The person who stops to take your survey has a different opinion about things than the person who says not right now. Shopkeepers are motivated, are doing some motivated reasoning here. So, and the best example of that, and this shows up again and again and again in the literature, is that shopkeepers consistently underestimate how many of their customers arrive on foot or by bike. They think it's 50% come by car, and it's actually 30% or 20%, depending on where you are. People ride the bus to downtown, you know, to go shopping. And it's the people who, this is, I'm being a little bit reductionist about this, but in general, you know, it's the person who blazes into your store in a huff saying they couldn't find parking and how terrible it is now, is the complaint that you remember. Whereas the people who you know, locked their bike to the no parking sign in front of your store and breezed right in, aren't complaining. They had a nice ride, you know, and so you don't remember that. You don't hear them complain. So I made this decision in the vein of what in science is called a meta-analysis. In science, you can, if there are a lot of studies on a particular subject, a researcher will do a meta-analysis. They'll take all the data from those studies, and then they'll do another analysis on the data altogether to see what the preponderance of evidence says, not just what any given study says. And so I was doing kind of in my head, I was doing a qualitative, like, journalism version of a meta-analysis. I wasn't going to aggregate all the data like a real researcher would, but I was going to read it all and say what the preponderance said. And what I decided was I wasn't going to use any of the survey studies, that I was going to say that they existed and say basically what they showed, which is, no, the bike lanes are fine for businesses. But there were a half a dozen, like six or seven papers that used better data, that used sales tax data, that used census data, that used, there were some proprietary data sets of national businesses and how they're doing, that used their actual numbers for how the business is going. And there are a couple of those. And there were researchers who were getting that and were looking at it. And in those studies, in places like New York and in San Francisco and in Los Angeles, Minneapolis, Cleveland, I think there's one in Cleveland, the researchers were also, they were learning methodologies. So in the last 15, 20 years, they were doing things like, it's not enough to compare your shopping street before and after the bike lane goes in. You also have to compare the shopping street to a place that's like that shopping street, but that didn't get a bike lane. So two different kinds of controls, before and after, but also yet got it and didn't. Study group, control group, good science. And you could do things like use Google Maps to compare where the areas were and how many parking spaces they actually lost. And you could say, well, how many parking spaces did this lane actually take away, and did that matter? And you could, you know, nobody started doing this yet, but eventually they're going to start using mobile phone data to figure out how people are actually moving around and who comes there too, which is a thing that transit planners are doing a lot in the United States now. And certainly we're starting to, before COVID messed up all the public transportation systems. So I read those. So that got me down to, you know, six big studies, including a recent one, 2020, that was, you know, from Portland State University, 250 pages long, and did all of that for six or seven different specific regions in different cities around the country as an exercise, not only to find out what happened with bike lanes, but to develop a really kind of rock solid methodology, because the idea is if you have a rock solid methodology and really good data, you can try to allay the fears, if indeed it turns out that they're okay, of the shopkeepers, but also you can put that in front of a city council and say, don't listen to those guys, they'll be fine.
Right. Sure.
So that's all methodology, which maybe you can tell where my obsessions are. That's why I got interested in it. And when I read them, the what all of them said essentially was, if we find a statistically significant change in the successfulness, the economic survival or thriving of these businesses along these protected bike lanes, if we find a significant effect at all, it is positive. They do better. In a couple of places, like there's one study in Seattle where they did wildly better, like 4x, but that doesn't always happen. It's usually less. And then you get into the weeds, like what actually changes. Because if you're a shopkeeper who sells paint, let's say you're a paint store, then you say, all well and good, but I got people coming in here buying 30 gallons of paint and a loading zone in front of my shop. What do you think is going to happen if I don't have that loading zone? I don't have parking in back. Or you have somebody who says, I'm the best framing store in town. So people are coming to me from every suburb in the city to get the best, you know, picture frames, best lamps. And nobody's riding my bike here. I'm in a downtown that, because I'm in an American downtown, you know, 50 years ago was destroyed by white flight and the end of streetcars. And 30 years ago was destroyed by a huge recession. And then 5 years ago was slammed by a pandemic that meant that no office workers come to this downtown anymore. And now you're telling me you don't want anybody to drive here. And I will say, these are valid concerns. That's for real. You know, the people who have businesses, in some of the studies, and it's hard to do this because you need a whole other set of coding to understand what kind of business it is on that retail stuff. Some of those kinds of businesses are places where people are either the shop itself needs a big loading thing in front because it doesn't have an alley because it's big bulk goods, or they're relying on a bigger watershed of customers from all over the region, or they're selling something that's big and heavy and it's just not good for a bike. You know, the bars and restaurants do great. They love it. You know? So these bike lanes have to be integrated into a larger system of thinking about cities, for sure. A downtown that's also putting in a lot of, or a neighborhood high street that's putting in a lot of new residential construction, you know, that's putting in a 501 apartment building, which I know people don't like, but they're fine with me, or that's building glass towers for residences, or that's just changed its zoning rules so that more people can build more houses. That means there are more people closer and they'll want to ride bikes. And people tend to be opposed to those too, another obsession of mine. But even with those differences, those effects on different kinds of businesses turn out to be small and inconsistent. And the overall effect still remains positive. These bike lanes are a boon for these shopping streets. More kinds of people come more often and more easily. And it's something that any business would want. I understand why a shopkeeper would be very concerned about change right now. Being in retail, being in food service is real scary, but this is not a change to be scared of.
So we've been speaking with Adam Rogers. His article in Business Insider is titled Bike Lanes Are Good for Business. I have a couple of comments and questions. We're seeing a new generation of people who may or may not want to drive and so are looking to live in an urban area where they can walk or bike. I also have the cargo bike, you know, phenomenon that's happening, both e-bike and pedal bike. And then you have all the bike share systems. So there are a lot of things that are encouraging people to bike. You also have a fact about building bike lanes that if you compare the building of a bike lane to the building of a road or a highway or a bridge, you put more people to work building a bike lane for a lot less money than you do building a bridge or a highway, you know, with concrete and whatever it is. So all in all, are you seeing any overall trends, something that you could actually extrapolate out to maybe 5 years or 10 years?
Well, I think certainly if my household is any indication, the data trend you indicate of younger people not wanting to drive is true. The race that I couldn't get into a car fast enough as a teenager, and my kids have little interest. One of them has none. The other one is like maybe, you know. And I think that's true across the board for Gen Alpha, Gen Z. Where are we? How do we describe teenagers now? I don't know.
I have no idea.
But so the cars are a hassle and they're expensive. And we've built this economy in this country where a car is essentially, because of the way we build, because of how far we put housing from, because of how little housing there is, because of the way we build roads, we built this economy where having a car is like the cost of entry. You know, a $30,000, whatever it is now, $8,000 a year ticket to participate in the American economy. That's bad for equality. That's bad for people. And the cars do bad things. There's a lot of externalities that we don't pay for. Right. So we have to provide alternatives. We want cities to continue to function. If we want people to still be able to get to work, if we want the rest of the economy to work, there have to be more options. And people, the joke about it is the war on cars, right? There's a very successful popular podcast about that people are saying like, oh, you don't want anybody to drive anymore. And, you know, I think like, well, you know, people should drive less, that's for sure. But let's start with letting people who don't want to drive have that choice. And I think that choice becomes more and more plausible in cities that are also open to building more places for people to live, more homes. Another thing that's true about my neighborhood is that it's the neighborhood in town where a lot of my neighbors are unhoused. And to me, you know, I'm reactionary about this. I'm like, look, there's no neighborhood character. There's no bay window. There's no little garden in a backyard to me that's more important than somebody dying in a street. I don't know what kind of society you can describe yourself as having if you're letting that happen.
Right.
And the way that you fix it, again, I've read a lot of this science, not all of it because there's a lot, but I've read a lot of this research. And it is very clear that the way you make sure there are not unhoused people is by building a lot of homes. And cities that do that, like Emeryville near me, seem to also almost magically also be very open to having protected bike lanes and a lot of bike paths. It's really interesting that those two things are associated.
Sounds like a new story.
Yeah, I actually should try to find a real, instead of me just asserting it on a podcast, is what I know
really
what I'm talking about.
Interesting observation that, you know, we're talking about housing unhoused people who I am so in that same camp with you. And then suddenly transportation becomes very important to these people. And many of them ride bikes to work, to whatever job they do get, or to whatever they're doing. Yes. Very interesting. Yeah.
I do think that the planning, the urban planning profession has professionalized in a way that has given them some more political influence, and that has changed its capacities and its goals. I've been reading urbanism since I was 18 or 19 years old as another separate obsession. And this is a profession, and it's all its associated professions, the economists who work in it, the sociologists who work in it, the architects and designers who work in it, who really are thinking like it's the job now not to just satisfy the whims of existing suburbanites, but to make places better for people who will come to them and people who are there now. And, you know, I was really struck by one of the other critiques that that Hopkins bike lane in my town leveled, is that Berkeley has a lot of older people because it hasn't built any housing in 30 years. So the people who lived here 30 years ago are still the ones who live here now. And a lot of them were very scared of the bikes. They were scared that if there was a bike lane that they had to cross, they'd be hit by the bike, that the bike would hurt them. And that was really, people were frightened. You know, I'm an older person with limited mobility, and I don't want to be mixed in or next to that, some cyclist whipping past, you know, with a little European cap and on a 2-pound carbon fiber frame. They were thinking of like road cycling, you know, Tour de France,
sure,
races or whatever. And the thing that struck me, not an unreasonable concern. I mean, and they were all remembering a few years ago, a person was killed by a cyclist here in Berkeley. And, you know, the one thing stands out in memory, of course, too, but they were forgetting all the people who were harmed by car crashes. And the reason that they were forgetting this, now I'm hypothesizing, I don't have data for this, is that cars have become the background. We don't see them anymore.
It's a good point.
We don't see it any more than people sort of notice the sky. You know, there's one of the theories about mammalian color vision, about why we see red so well and kind of don't identify blue and green as much, as even though there's more blue and green in the world, is the idea that like, we were looking for ripe fruit when we were evolving. This hypothesis has a lot of problems. We're looking for ripening fruit, these red and yellow and orange colors. Hmm. And the blues and greens, the trees and the sky and the water were just context. So our brains were like, that's not the important part. But if you see something enough every day, it becomes context, it becomes the background. And I think in our cities, cars have just become the background, and people only notice them when you say, maybe we should have less of those. People freak out, how am I going to get to work? The idea that people were more scared of getting hit by a bike than getting hit by all the cars jockeying for the few parking spaces was really shocking to me. I've gone far afield from your question. The point is, I do think there are trends.
Yes. I think it's a very valid point that it's another place I hadn't thought of, that pedestrians are afraid of bikes, cars are afraid of bikes and pedestrians, and yet more people are dying by cars than by bikes. That is for sure.
I just looked up the number last night. It's
It's scary. 40,000 people last year, if I am not mistaken, were injured or killed by a car.
Oh, that's just the deaths.
Oh, that is just the deaths.
Yeah, 45,000 is just deaths. It's millions of injuries. Yeah,
it's absurd.
And you know, we can do better than that. We can fix that. That's the thing we can fix. You can look at it and go like, "Well, we can fix that. That's fixable. We can do something about that."
But will we?
Right.
Political will. That's another whole topic. Well, Adam, this has just been a wonderful conversation. I wish we could go on all day. We've been speaking with Adam Rogers. He is the senior tech correspondent for Business Insider. He covers science, technology, our weird future, and boy, it's weird. He reports on how technology changes the way we live. His article, Bike Lanes Are Good for Business, was published on March 7th. We will have it on our website. You can just log into Business Insider and see it. Thank you for taking time to talk with me. I hope we get to talk again because you are fascinating.
That's very kind of you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. Take care.
You too.
My thanks to Adam Rogers for joining me. As I said, I could have talked with him all day. His article, Bike Lanes Are Good for Business, is linked on our site, outspokencyclist.com, or you can find it on Business Insider. And you might want to delve into some of his other work, much of it linked on his bio. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll speak with journalist and author Peter Flax about his new book, Live to Ride, Finding Joy and Meaning on a Bicycle. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. Peter Flax is a bike rider. He not only says so at the beginning of his new book, he has and does live it. In Live to Ride, Finding Joy and Meaning on a Bicycle, Peter breaks down his thinking into distinct categories such as adventure, speed, and self-expression. Each chapter of the book is punctuated by people, photographs, and commentary that represent the title of the chapter. I caught up with Peter at the Austin airport when he was waiting for his plane to take him back to LA. Hi, Peter. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for being my guest. It's nice to talk with you again.
Likewise, it's great to be here and talk to you once again.
Yeah, well, we've had several conversations over the years, beginning in December of 2010. And the reason that's relevant is I started this podcast in September of 2010. And also in that year, you became editor-in-chief of Bicycling.
Right. And I believe we met at an event in Ohio, perhaps, where we gave away bikes. Is that right? Am I remembering that correctly?
No, I don't think so. Maybe.
Okay. No, maybe that I'm forgetting. But it has been almost 15 years.
A long time. I mean, we've spoken, you know, periodically over the years. But yeah, our first encounter was then. Catch us up a little bit on what's ensued. I mean, I've been following you for a while, both on social media and just knowing being in the industry. But catch us up on what you've been doing and how you transitioned to writing the book, which is what we're going to talk about, your new book, Live to Ride, Finding Joy and Meaning on a Bicycle. And it's a hardbound book, which I love. And like, it's tactile, you can touch it. It's not just like something online. So yeah, tell us what you've been doing.
Okay, well, since 2010, for maybe 4 years, I was editor-in-chief of Bicycling, and then got fired from that job and moved to LA.
What do you mean fired?
Yeah, it was the CEO of the company that owned Bicycling felt like I was like a bike racer guy, and that like the brand wanted to be more open to all riders. So it's like a terrific irony of like where we're winding up talking today. I never felt like that's who I was, but when you swim in the deep waters of corporate publishing, that sometimes things go that way. And I moved to LA 10 years ago and got a job at the Hollywood Reporter, which was actually a great place to work. But it meant that I was no longer like employed to write about bikes. And it and at the same time, I transitioned from mostly riding for recreation to being a utility rider who just commuted in Los Angeles. And so the last 10 years in a lot of ways has been a journey of like finding a new identity within bike culture that's different than the one I had before. And this book is in a lot of ways a product of that journey.
So it's interesting that you say you went from being a recreational rider to sort of a utilitarian rider. When I think of Los Angeles, I don't think of good riding infrastructure there. And you have written about that in the past. I don't know how it's changed in the last few years, but it's something that we're talking about a lot on the show, infrastructure and urban planning and the way transitions are being made for younger people not wanting to drive. They want to ride. So I just think it's interesting that you've transitioned that way. the publication of your book is kind of interesting right now at the beginning of the 2024 cycling season. And the bicycle business has changed so much. You capture the essence of a lot of my thinking in the last 40 years. So maybe 35 years ago when I owned my own store and I would write nasty letters to Bicycle Dealer Showcase, which was the trade journal at the time instead of Bicycle Retailer, I would get a lot of negative response to the fact that I feel like the bicycle business is like a bunch of little tiny factions. And what is it that could unite us all as bicycle people, just people who want to ride bicycles? So the way you describe what I've always called the factions, I think is interesting. So tell me about the essence of your book and how you came to describe it.
Yeah, I mean, I think for a long time, I adhered to this unspoken hierarchy within bike culture where whether riders realize it or not, they're slotted into a subculture of like, are you a roadie? Are you a mountain biker? Are you a triathlete? Are you a commuter? Whatever it is you are. And that folks in that subculture are, you know, use particular kinds of equipment and wear certain kinds of clothes and have their own rules. And the experience of moving to LA and realizing that my life had evolved in a way where I didn't really feel like I belonged to any of those subcultures. Like I had one foot in a bunch of them and not both feet in any of them, made me slowly realize, you know, that everybody who rides is interconnected. And so much of what the book is about is an exploration of all these things that everyone who rides has in common, that instead of just being like, oh, this person wears baggy shorts or this person wears jeans or whether your handlebar is like flat or curved, that we're all interconnected in all these ways. And that in particular, in the, you know, in the relation to things like safety and infrastructure, that the way that riders will have the most power in our culture is by uniting, that having like tons of smaller subgroups doesn't help us with advocacy and unity. And so I do think there's like some quiet advocacy to the thesis of the book of like wanting everyone who rides to feel like they're one big block.
Let's take your book apart a little bit. It's divided into sections titled Adventure, Speed, Utility, Nature, Competition, and Self-Expression. I'm not sure self-expression might not be a kind of an overarching, you know, quality to each of those, but how did you come up with those six categories?
Well, I mean, I just tried to, I spent about a year thinking before I started writing and was just trying to think of like why I ride and why people I know ride, and really tried to talk to people who have different sorts of riding lives and just tried to write notes and create some structure for it. And oddly enough, I originally had seven chapters, and self-expression was two different ideas, because it's really about this sort of beauty and individuality, which is a big part. And then the self-expression part of like feeling the sense of inclusiveness being important within bike culture. And so I like combined those into one idea where it's about like representing some piece of yourself and feeling accepted for that piece of yourself as one big idea. It's just a construct to get at the things that drive people to ride. And what I found is that people who were bike riders were bike racers, excuse me, were increasingly interested in safety and advocacy and were riding to the coffee shop, and the people who ride in cities were still relating to the adventure of being on a bike ride. And so I really just tried to distill it down to these qualities that everyone could relate to.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce you. We're speaking with Peter Flax. His new book is Live to Ride, Finding Joy and Meaning on a Bicycle. And everybody who listens to this podcast clearly finds joy riding a bicycle, however they ride, or he rides, or they she rides. So you chose a bunch of interesting people to highlight each of these sections of the book. How did you come to, do you know all these people like personally, or did you seek out these people?
I knew everyone with the exception of Anne Hidalgo, the mayor of Paris, who I do not know. But I have been in bike media and bike culture for a long time. And so in some ways, leaning on people that I really care about or really respect who I know. And I really tried to, like, in each chapter, individually and collectively, pick people that showed the different sides of that idea. If I'm talking about adventure, you know, I didn't want to just exclusively rely on professional mountain bikers who do, you know, epic adventures. I wanted to really capture the breadth of these ideas, and really representation felt important, and kept an eye on, like, who I was inviting to be a part of the book. Because, like, collectively, I wanted it to be a statement about, you know, kind of who's in the gang in bike culture. And it's a huge range of people.
It is. It is. And a lot of it's so much fun for me to read it, because so many of these people I've also spoken with for the podcast. And I'm like, I remember them. I remember them. So what do you think has changed in cycling, and sort of by extension, has changed cyclists over a past generation? Because now we're hearing kids don't want to drive. And I just did an interview with Ralph Bueller, who's a professor at Virginia Tech, whose studies have found that children are not learning to ride a bike. They're not being taught to ride. So what's changed, and how do you think we can maybe change it back so that we get a new generation of riders?
Yeah, I'm not sure that I see it as clearly as like needing to change it back. Like, the bike culture is always shifting, and that during the early years of the pandemic, there was a big boom in participation and interest in bikes. And so I see it as this, like, oscillating thing where interest goes up and down, but surely there are a lot of kids growing up who aren't learning to ride like I did when I was a kid, that there are more people who live in these urban and suburban and exurban places where parents are afraid about their children being in the street on a bike or on foot, right? Like, I remember I grew up in the suburbs and we played, like, stickball in the street. And I think now you have to really get out into a really rural area to find somewhere where people feel safe, their children playing in the street. But I think there is this growing sense, at least for people who are lovers of bikes or adjacent to that, that the bikes can actually really change the world for the better, that we have all these problems going on in our culture, whether it's just, like, traffic, air quality, climate change, public health, you know, people finding they're just perpetually online and connected digitally. And for so these and so many other problems, like, bikes are a potential answer to them. And so I think there's a greater sense now that bikes are more than a hobby, right? Like, I think that in the world I inhabited 15 years ago, well, there was a lot of people for whom they were just, like, enthusiasts who did something for fun. And I think everybody that I know, even in those spaces now, realizes that bikes are transportation, that bikes can transform cities, that bikes can be a way that you can express something about yourselves. And so I think part of what I'm tapping into, or I hope I'm tapping into in the book, is like those ideas taking root or starting to take root in bike culture.
So this is sort of a question that I'm not sure you can answer, but it's one that I'm having trouble answering. And that is the cost of entry for a bicyclist, and this may be not happening everywhere, but we happen to know in our area, Northeast Ohio, of quite a few bike shops who are closing their doors, which is not a good thing, because then you don't have a neighborhood shop, and a neighborhood shop is important for neighborhood cycling. And then the cost of a bicycle, one that isn't a Walmart bicycle, which I'm not saying Walmart doesn't make a bicycle you could ride. They do. But a bike shop bike, you used to be able to go in and buy a reasonably priced bike shop bike. And today, I'm not sure you can. Do you think that that's a deterrent?
I think it's a factor. I mean, I think like a lot of industries, there's a lot of consolidation going on in the bike industry. And so shops are closing, or, you know, there's more like direct to consumer sales now of bikes, which cut the local shop out. But I get asked this question a lot, and that, you know, with the exception of this maybe 18 months during the pandemic where finding a used bike was really difficult, that once again, finding a used bike is really great, right? Like there's a lot of people who made impulse purchases during the pandemic who now aren't riding. And so, yeah, if you put a little time into it, you know, I would rather buy a super high quality used bike and then bring it into a shop versus buying a big box store bike of lesser quality. So, and frankly, a lot of the bike companies, after being out of inventory, built like heck, and now bike shops are overflowing. And arguably, it's one of the better times to get a deal on a bike than in past years, because everyone's trying to get bikes off the floor.
That's true. That is true. There is an inventory glut right now. You know, it's this ebb and flow that just during the pandemic, it was insane. You couldn't even get inner tubes. So I get what you're saying. And it never even occurred to me that there would be a great used bike market right now. Of course there is.
It's as someone who I bought a used steel bike last year, It was like the best time in a decade to go online looking for used bikes, because people made so many impulse purchases. The other thing I'll add is that bikes are not cheap, and I understand that there's a barrier for people to get on something really super high quality. But at the same time, part of it is evolving from this mindset of just thinking you're buying a toy to thinking you're buying something that's real transportation. Like I live in Los Angeles and I don't have a car, and I get to work, which is 15 miles each way on a bike. And I'm not saying that's something that everybody would want to do, but that when you start thinking like, oh, I could be making trips that are 2 or 3 miles to the store with a bike, or oh, if I think about how much I'm spending on a gym membership, and this could like replace that, there are a lot of ways to think about it where then the cost of a bike is something that's going to last you for so many years and bring a lot of, like I said in the book, meaning and joy.
Meaning and joy. I'm really glad that you bought a steel bike too.
Yeah, I'm very happy on it.
Yeah, we're not going to have that carbon fiber conversation. Well, I know you're waiting for a plane. I really appreciate you taking time to speak with me. I really appreciate you writing the book. It's Live to Ride, Finding Joy and Meaning on a Bicycle. Peter Flax, journalist, bike rider, and commuter. I love that you don't even own a car in LA. That's sort of like unheard of. Tell listeners where they can get a copy of the book.
Well, the book, as you said, is called Live to Ride, and it's available at least online everywhere that you would buy a book. Like a lot of the local book sale sellers in your area can surely get it, but it's on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and Target and everywhere else that sells books online.
I'm glad it's doing well. I hope it continues to do well. It's a really good book to have on your shelf, and I hope that all my listeners take a chance to get a copy. Thank you, Peter. Have a safe trip home. And I hope we get to talk again.
We love that. Thanks. Good to talk to you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
My thanks to Peter Flax for taking time out of his travels to chat with me. You know, I think he nails it when he talks about people who ride and how their reasons for riding manifest themselves. I believe we are all interested in safety and advocacy and have a common interest in our love of the bike, regardless of how we might try to pigeonhole ourselves. I like the book a lot, and if you want to have a copy of Thoughtful Discourse on your shelves, you would do well to get Live to Ride, Finding Joy and Meaning on a Bicycle. It's available wherever you buy your books. My thanks to you for tuning in to the show today. I hope you enjoyed the conversations. Remember that you can find show notes, links, and photos on our website, outspokencyclist.com, and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Oh, X. I'll be back soon with a brand new episode, so if you don't want to miss it, why not take a moment to subscribe to the podcast on your favorite app and maybe leave a comment while you're at it. I hope you have a great week. Stay safe, stay well, and remember, there is always time for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We welcome your thoughts and contributions on our Facebook page, or visit outspokencyclist.com to leave a comment on any episode. We will be back next week with new guests, topics, conversations, and news from the world of cycling. Subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app and you'll never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.